everybody, and welcome to Movie Crush. It's Charles W. Chuck Bryant here, not in our home studio in Atlanta, Georgia, but at my home away from home studio, CDM Studios, 9th Avenue, New York City. So I had Paul Schneider in here today, and Paul is someone I met. Actually, the story of how we met, it's kind of funny. I don't know if you remember, if you're a Stuff You Should Know listener, but quite a few years ago, I put out a call when I found out that somebody, I can't even remember who it was, sort of famous, had listened to the show. I got a big kick out of that, and I said, hey, if there's anyone else out there that's kind of famous, send me an email and let me know, because I would like to know that. And I got one reply, and that was from Paul Schneider. He sent me an email that said, hey, I don't know how famous I am, but my name is Paul Schneider, and I'm an actor, and blah, blah, blah. And I read it, and I was like, dude, I know Paul Schneider. I'm a big fan of his. And so it was kind of cool, and we started a little pen pal friendship. And then we were able to meet. He came to a Stuff You Should Know live show in New York, and we were able to chat a little bit before and after, and we've since been email pen pals. And that's kind of how it all got started. We're kind of similar dudes. He's a little younger, but in the same age range. And he's from the South, from Asheville, North Carolina. And so we kind of relate to one another, I think, in a lot of ways. And Paul was an obvious choice for when I came to New York to do some of these recording sessions here. And it was great. What a great conversation. It's a supersized one because we talked a lot about all kinds of things. Whenever I get such an accomplished actor in here who's worked on everything from Parks and Rec on TV to movies directed by Jane Campion and Warren Beatty, for God's sake, I gotta quiz him about that stuff. And we did that for a while, and then we finally honed in on Back to the Future. And that conversation just went great. A good deep dive into Back to the Future, one of the great movies of all time. And so here we go. I don't want to keep delaying this one. Paul Schneider on Back to the Future right now.
I wrote down notes for your program, so I'm not. I mean, I'm taking it very seriously.
Are you still teaching?
No, I'm not.
What was that all about? Was it acting or directing or writing? Or
I taught directing actors.
Oh,
to
cool.
Graduate school directing students.
Columbia.
At Columbia.
How'd that go?
I really loved it.
Uh-huh.
I didn't go back because I kind of needed to work
right.
for money. but it was explaining to these kids like what I felt like actors needed in that situation was like A, pretty surprising that they didn't know.
Right.
And B, kind of easy that it's basically just kind of psychology 101.
Right.
It's like, and like being a good coach, you know, like encouragement. And,
uh-huh.
You know, like say three nice things before you give a criticism. And,
right.
You know, it's like
life skills almost.
It's very all I needed to know I learned in kindergarten stuff.
It's crazy when I hear stories about these directors, like the tyrannical directors who, I just don't get that.
And I don't, the whole William Friedkin, you know, shooting guns next to Ellen Burstyn's head and stuff.
Yeah.
Like, I there's no way I would deal with that. There's just no fucking way that
yeah.
I just wouldn't deal with it.
Right.
This is not the end of the world type stuff. We're
right.
making a movie, you know.
Right.
It should be fun.
Yeah.
That's why I don't understand auditions sometimes, because the amount of time they give you to prepare, the quality of air in the room.
Uh-huh.
I mean, just in terms of sort of attitude in the room,
the
vibe, I guess. It doesn't give you a chance to, like, if I want to know how great an actor you are,
mm-hmm.
I am going to make you comfortable, as
mm-hmm.
comfortable as I can.
Yeah.
I'm going to kind of free up ourselves in terms of conversation. I'm going to not shut it down your ideas.
Right.
I'm going to make sort of a free-flowing, brainstormy environment.
Thing, yeah.
So that I get all of Chuck. I see, oh, he's got this idea about this and that idea about that.
Mm-hmm.
But when I sort of close it all down, all I'm getting is the very cocooned, protected Chuck, who's only throwing out ideas that he's pretty sure he's already kind of vetted in his brain. It's like writing and editing at the same time.
Right.
It's just so hard.
Yeah. You just have to write and then go back.
Right, which is why when I'm working with, I brought this T-shirt for you.
Oh, nice.
I wore this T-shirt for you, I should say. I saw these T-shirts and they were online, and it said like, directed by Martin Scorsese, directed by all these people.
Uh-huh.
And I was thinking, well, I have been directed by Jane Campion.
That's great. That's fucking awesome.
So it's like this is a literal interpretation of the shirt.
Yeah, he's wearing a directed by Jane Campion shirt because you were.
We'll take a picture of it later.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we're going to get a photo.
Yeah.
One thing I always appreciate about you, though, is that you sort of have aside from obviously having to make a living, you've always seemed to have a take it or leave it attitude. Like, I always get the feeling that you could just go away from it all at any moment.
Kind of cool. Sure. Yeah, I always – was it Rick Moranis who just, like, up and
mm-hmm.
– and
to be with his kids after his wife died, like, be a father.
Who could possibly be offended by that? And I one thing that I've always thought about is in acting – and sort of this baloney celebrity culture we live in, if your next thing isn't double the size of your last thing.
Right.
If you're not constantly being more, if your image is not constantly more and more propagated, if people don't see more and more of you, then the idea is somehow things have gone wrong.
Right.
And I when I left Parks and Recreation, I was doing the size movies, you know, like Bright Star, that I really love doing.
Yeah.
I have financial concerns like everyone else. I want things, you know. I'd like to spend summers in Spain or whatever. But my overhead is, my personal overhead is really low.
Yeah.
And I like the idea of being sort of a middle class actor, if you know what I mean. Like,
totally, man.
Of course I want to work with great directors. I want to work with Jane Campion and you know, the people that I really, really loved when I was growing up.
Yeah.
But I just can't see myself doing something that I don't really like.
Yeah.
For what? Like, what's the payoff? Is it money?
Right.
Well, yeah, sure. And that's great. But I've met a lot of insanely wealthy people.
Mm-hmm.
And the general vibe I get is not. And I mean, like, at film parties or film festivals or at panels or whatever, you know. Uh-huh. And the vibe you get from some of these folks that are at the tippy top of the acting profession, it's not a contented Dalai Lama-esque vibe, man.
Right.
It is like bundles of insecurity and bundles of nerves, and I have that just myself, you know.
Right.
Like, I don't need to go get more of that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I was talking to my wife about this, obviously it's all about the material. Everyone says that, but it's true. I'm not concerned about where I shoot or how much money I make. It's all about, like, do I feel attached to whatever this guy is they're suggesting I play?
Mm-hmm.
And do I it doesn't even have to be like a great entire script.
Right.
Like, I might want to do a character just 'cause, like, I don't think the script is great, but there's something I like about the character himself.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like there's got to be something that I can add to it that I feel like only I can add to it.
Right.
Not that anybody else couldn't do a good job, but there's a reason why I could say, excuse me, let me take a crack at this.
Right.
And oftentimes characters written, you know, I think sometimes the larger the budget, and the larger you might be paid and the larger your image, you know, the more your image might be propagated and the more, quote, famous you might get, oftentimes those roles, because they have to appeal to the broadest possible audience to make back their capital investment, it can't be that specific.
Mm-hmm.
It can't be that interesting. it has to be sort of a bland lead character that everyone can sort of find something to invest in.
Mm-hmm.
It's a broad drawing, not a very deep drawing.
Yeah, because
you get into that.
You got on Parks and Rec, which was a great show,
mm-hmm.
and that's sort of the golden goose for a lot of actors to get that weekly network series. But I've talked to you about it and read articles in interviews and stuff. That seems to kind of have been the case there. It's like it just wasn't character-wise, didn't offer you enough, and you were, I think, brave enough to say, like, you know what, this isn't my bag.
Yeah, yeah. And,
that's a
tough thing to walk away from. And they were brave enough to say, this isn't your bag. It was a mutual us not being into it. But because the forces being what they were, I kind of signed on for one character that I thought was specific and interesting.
Mm-hmm.
That being a guy who... He was kind of this really promiscuous guy, but he was kind of an Eddie Bauer guy, like a really kind of buttoned up dude. But he had also had sex with everyone in town and couldn't remember who he had had sex with.
Mm-hmm.
But he was very polite about it.
Right.
And I thought that was super funny. And then later, kind of because, as the characters were kind of shaken down and I guess they figured out, like, how do we, you know, weight these characters properly.
Right.
I think my character's specificity sort of, you know, was diluted.
Mm-hmm.
And I think both they and myself realized that for myself, I just need to go in there and be challenged. It's not...
Right.
If the way I think of it is like this, I've got 12, you know, horrifying, angry sled dogs in my head. And if those sled dogs have nothing to pull, I'm screwed.
Right.
You know, free time, not being challenged, and I think this is probably true for all of us. But when those sled dogs have something heavy to pull,
mm-hmm.
I'm like in Bright Star.
Yeah.
I was terrified. I had a lot going on.
Right.
I was asked to do a lot of things that I was pretty sure I couldn't do. And that made me kind of, you know, sort of terrified and satisfied at the end of every day.
Well, those sled dogs, want to run.
That's all they want to do.
You know?
And I can't, I'm not the solo artist, you know? I'm the collaborator artist, and I can't give them a sled to pull myself.
Yeah.
Usually.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways.
Are you looking to direct again? Like, what you got in the hopper? Can you talk about it?
I'd love to. Directing is certainly something that I feel most, like, wrung out doing.
Mm-hmm.
Even when I was teaching and talking about directing with the students, it was...
wrung out in a satisfying sense?
Absolutely satisfying. You know, okay. like a rag, like completely, you know, wrung out. And, I think of that as a very positive thing. As far as directing performance is concerned... You know, there's some things being written. There's some, you know, mm-hmm. play ideas being kicked around.
Oh, cool.
I'd love to direct theater. And that's kind of, you know, those projects are all in sort of germinating stages. And
I had Tony Shalhoub in here yesterday. He said he'd met you a few times.
Really?
Have you met him? Or was he thinking of someone else?
He and I may have terrible memories.
Okay. That's possible.
I love Tony Shalhoub.
Yeah, he was great.
He's awesome.
It was very cool. It was Barton Fink was like the first thing I saw him in. It's one of my all-time faves. So
totally. In fact, I have the kind of memory where if I had met someone that I really admire, I would not remember it because brain would convince me that I wouldn't be so lucky to have met them.
That's funny. I have a pretty poor memory for a lot of things, but like... When it comes to stuff like that, it's locked.
See, I can tell you the first American to climb Mount Everest.
Who was it?
Well, Jim Whittaker.
Okay.
or the first person to climb it without oxygen. Reinhold Messner. But I can't, you know, wife's birthdays.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's just sort of a mess of a...
Congratulations on getting married, too, by the way.
Thank you very much.
Since I've seen you last, that happened.
Yeah.
It's good, huh?
She's a lot smarter than me.
Yeah. Well, that's what you should always do.
Yeah. It's a terrifying prospect.
So as far as your, like, you grew up in North Carolina.
I did.
100%, right? Like from birth or?
No. I moved there when I was four.
Oh, okay. Where were you born?
I was born in outside of Oakland, California.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So you end up in what part of North Carolina was it?
It was, when I grew up, it was just outside of the Asheville city limits.
Right.
This was pre-cool, hip
right.
Asheville.
Mm-hmm. I just went last year, actually.
Yeah. And sure. But, you know, hometowns are sort of, you know, I have a sort of a love-hate relationship with it because you sort of want... You grew up outside of...
Yeah, just outside of Atlanta.
Right. You know, you kind of want your hometown to stay like a little, like a snow globe, you know? Mm-hmm. We live these crazy transient lives and everybody's changing, but you want this memory to stay completely fixed.
Right.
And it just doesn't. And it's, you know, it's of course it doesn't. That's my fault for wanting something to happen that's impossible. But yeah, I when I was there, you know, there was only one, you know, the only music scene was like one Trit concert a year. And the last time I went there, well, a few years ago, I went there and like Ghostface Killer was playing.
Oh, wow.
I was like, what the hell?
Yeah.
It's like if we had this.
Uh-huh.
But when I was there, you know, we would read the liner notes of a, you know, of like Physical Graffiti or, you know, another Led Zeppelin album. And we would just say, like, who are these people? You know, it just seemed like they were making this music on Mars or something. Like,
yeah.
It was just so far away from. But same with movies and same with actors and same with directors. And, you know, the idea of being involved with that world was really just. In fact, the idea didn't occur to you.
Yeah, I've talked about that very thing on this. I've had friends that knew that it seems like you almost had to have grown up in L.A. and maybe New York, but definitely L.A. to know that, like, that's a job that you can go get.
Yeah.
But for dudes like us that grew up in the South in these kind of smaller southern cities, I didn't know that that was an option.
Mm-mm. Or even, I mean, I guess one way it could happen is if, you know, your dad or mom had a friend who ran the community theater in the small
right.
town or something. But my parents didn't know those people either.
Uh-huh.
So even someone, you know, in the small town version of the arts, I didn't know those people.
Yeah,
I didn't either.
My parents weren't even big movie or music people.
Mine,
I was on my own. My brother was obviously an older brother, always helps.
Yeah,
or an
yeah.
older sibling.
Yeah.
But you need those influences.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're just adrift.
And the times that you're adrift, you know, when you do, you know, when I did discover Peter Greenaway, like, on my own, when I saw The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover when I was, I guess, like, 18.
Yeah, I saw that in the theater for some weird reason.
I did too.
Yeah.
Like that, when you find something like that on your own, you feel like this is mine.
Yeah.
You know, like nobody knows about this.
You can be the influencer.
Yeah, exactly. And I feel like that kind of stuff is a little more, you know, it's a little more hard won and it's a little more, I guess it's a little more special to you because nobody gave it to you. You kind of. But that was why I got into, or that was why I went to film schools because I've told this story before, but because my parents and I saw The Piano.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And then you end up working with her.
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Before The Piano, it was, I think, I really didn't have any career. I just didn't have any career thoughts. I mean, it was just like, you know, I just thought I would smoke pot.
Right.
And that would be whatever job that, you know, whatever job that is. And then after I saw The Piano, it was really just like a light switch. Like before it was no film school. And then after it was, film school.
Wow. So that was the North Carolina School of the Arts?
Yeah, that's right.
Wow. So before that, were you were you going to movies with your parents or friends? Do you have siblings?
I do have an older brother. We went to movies as a family, and I think we probably, you know, if one is a family that doesn't go to movies at all together, and 10 is and 10 was a family that went to like every movie together, yeah. We were probably like a 4.
Right.
But I do remember my dad taking me to see Die Hard in 1988.
Pretty cool.
That was, and I was 12, and that just ripped my brain open, and I, you know, in the list of questions that you sent me, you asked about R-rated movies, and I don't remember my first R-rated movie, but I did remember going to see Die Hard with my dad,
right,
and Goodfellas,
which is rated R.
And then Goodfellas with my dad,
right, oh wow,
and both of those were very, well, you know.
Impactful.
Affecting, yeah.
So when you get to, and we can get into however much of this you want to, but at North Carolina School of the Arts is that where you met David Gordon Green?
Yeah.
And
Danny McBride and all those guys, yeah.
So you were all just dudes in school together?
We were all just dudes in school together.
That's kind of crazy.
Yeah, we were making short films together.
Wow.
I was, you know, David was in my short, I mean, we made many short films, but like, you know, David was in one of my short films. Mm-hmm. I was in his short film. I was in Danny's short film.
Right.
And actually, Danny had made a short film that was a riff on Back to the Future.
Where
I was wearing this, you know, this facsimile of Marty's,
the vest,
you know, that everyone mistakes as a life vest, but yeah, we were all there, and it's very strange to. I actually watched a really amazing documentary series recently about, if I'm not mistaken, it's about the. Like the avalanche or mountain services rescue team in Chamonix in France.
Uh-huh.
And it's just this great group of French guys and women, and they get on helicopters and they save tourists.
Right.
That are like, have fallen down these ice, you know, chasms. And I, you know, and then the series ended and I realized another guy that we went to school, like, with produced it.
So. Oh, wow.
Yeah, so this guy named Brian Mandel.
Yeah,
so.
That's crazy just to have that amount of talent come out of a smallish town.
And yeah.
One of the lesser known film schools, probably.
Well, and when we were there, we were in the second class.
What does that mean?
It was the
second ever?
Ever, yeah. Like,
oh,
so
wow.
When we graduated, we were in the second graduating class.
Uh-huh.
So.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
You know the movie, I can't think of the name of it now like a dummy because I didn't look it up, but the indie that I saw you in not too long ago, the...
Goodbye to All That?
Yeah.
Yeah, with Heather Graham and...
So good.
Yeah. And Angus McLaughlin, who... We shot that in Winston-Salem.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Who directed that?
Angus McLaughlin.
Oh.
He wrote... you got to edit this. He wrote... the one that Amy Adams got really famous? It's Alessandro Nivola, and it's like set in North Carolina about an arts.
Oh, Junebug.
Junebug, yeah.
Right.
Angus wrote Junebug, and then he, I believe this was his directorial debut, that one, based on his script.
Well, and I've talked, I do these smaller, non-interview shows now for this, where I have a lot of interaction with like people from the listeners, like emails and top 10 lists and stuff like that. And I do a recommended viewing, and I did All the Real Girls for one of the installments.
Mm-hmm.
And still just one of the great, great romance movies ever to me. Such a sweet, genuine movie.
Yeah. It really... I mean, it's such a weird, it's, you know, it's like looking in your own, it's like looking at your photo album with an audience.
Yeah.
And it's very, I mean, you know, I have, obviously I have mixed feelings about it because, you know, it's like I can't, it's hard to get totally on board. I mean, as a piece of sort of, if I can view it as a piece of separate, mm-hmm. you know, art, like, yeah, I like it for that reason. I also like it for the reason that it was just a group of friends and mm-hmm. we're just trying to do this thing. And I thought that was really great. But also it's kind of tough to get, you know, my memories of it were so, you know, it was about such a horrible, you know, it was about such a horrible breakup in yeah. my early life and, you know, all the amount of emotion that was poured into it and pain that was poured into it. And maybe that's what makes it enjoyable for other people, but it's sort of, you know, when you make something, you know, when you kind of make something out of a crappy situation.
Right.
And people love it. And yeah. you think like, oh, that's great. But
yeah,
man, it was hard.
Was it?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Well, I mean, sure. it was so real. And everyone, I think the reason why people love that movie is because you can just so identify with that raw emotion of being that age and just mm-hmm. how important those first loves were.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's nothing like it. You can go on your life and mm-hmm. have a million relationships, but those first ones are just so impactful and raw because you don't know how to deal with any of those feelings yet.
And the chemicals in your brain are like roaring
all over the place.
I mean, it like every day feels like a Mogwai song.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, missing a phone call, especially that, you know.
Yeah.
In those days when there was, you know, when there were no cell phones.
Uh-huh. You missed a phone call.
You know, when you get home and your mom said, a young lady called. It felt like, it's like a Mogwai song did start
right.
in your head. And you were like, what was her name?
Right.
And she's like,
what does she sound like?
I don't remember. And you're like, no. So.
Yeah, that's so funny. So yeah. True. All right. Well, we can get to Back to the Future now.
Yeah.
I should tell everyone that the original, not the original plan, but the plan that you hatched a couple of days ago was, hey, why don't you come over and watch it the night before? And I thought that was a great idea. But then you very wisely, I think, said, you know what? Maybe we should not watch it together because then we'll be recreate. Because there's no way we could have sat down and watched it
and not
talked about it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In real time.
Yeah.
So and I think
in fact,
right
I watched
move.
It last night and said a lot of the lines out loud, and I just, you know, it was better that I was alone.
Yeah, for sure, and I did too. So I like to think it's kind of funny that you and I were both in New York.
Here, do you want to go through the questions first?
Because sure.
I don't want to forget your questions.
Yeah,
because
yeah,
I like the
questions.
Idea of a beat. Yeah, because I like the idea of your like consistent, you know, like consistent questions for each guest.
Okay,
I think that's great.
All right.
Also, I have a great first movie for you.
All right. Well, then let's go into five questions. What's yeah. the first movie you remember seeing in the theater?
The Elephant Man by David Lynch.
What was going on
this
there?
This is a true thing. It came out in 1980 when I was four.
Okay.
And this is right before we moved from California to North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And my mom she did daycare. So she brought a gang of us to the movie Song of the South.
Yeah, yeah.
A movie that was re-released in 1980
mm-hmm.
and now banned because it's horrifyingly racist.
Yeah.
But at that time, it was Disney.
Right.
And we all know Disney is lily white and pure and perfect.
I remember the re-release for sure.
Yeah. And yeah. when I worked in Raleigh, North Carolina, I worked in a tape duplication place, duping videotapes.
Right.
And a lot of people wanted, they wanted PAL transfers to NTSC
right.
of Song of the South on videotape.
Mm-hmm.
So I would make a lot of those transfers. But what happened is my mom took all the kids to Song of the South.
Mm-hmm.
I think not having any idea of its racist overtones.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I needed to use the restroom. And I remember it was one of those early situations where you have to go into the ladies' restroom with your mom when you're a kid, and that's a little, whatever. It's strange. And so we walked out of the restroom together, and she, I guess, wasn't paying attention, but I walked right into The Elephant Man, which was playing in the theater next to Song of the South. And I walked in, and it was, it was black and white, and I was standing there staring at the screen, and it was a moment where John Merrick is in the hospital, and this nurse is bringing him up some tea, and she sees him for the first time, and she drops the tea tray. And when I, as a four-year-old, saw his face and his hair and in a suit, the way he was dressed, I just, it was like...
It's probably traumatizing.
It was. It was really shocking. Like, my whole nervous system was kind of stopped.
Uh-huh.
And to this day, strangely, it's become something where the song Zippity-Doo-Da from Song of the South terrifies me. But I love the movie The Elephant Man.
That's
like
funny.
It still is.
Yeah.
You have like 100 top five films.
Sure.
Well, 20 top five films.
Right.
And it's definitely one of those.
But that song, though, conjures up fear still.
The song, the song Zippity-Doo-Da, not unlike The Magician's Apprentice from Fantasia, those kind of happy sounding things are just like a broken carousel for me.
Yeah, it's funny how those songs, whatever trauma is going on in your life when you're a kid, those songs years later. I have one from the Bee Gees, How Deep Is Your Love. I had a very dark, scary day in elementary school one day, and my father was my high school principal, ran into my dad's office crying, and that song was on. So to this day, I mean, all these years later, that fucking song comes on, and it just triggers something. It's like, it's science in my body.
I guess Oliver Sacks would have talked about how the song, the music would imprint deeper than the visuals.
Yeah.
Because when I'm telling you that story and I'm gathering together the visuals of what happened, the dress my mom is wearing, I know is a dress I saw in a photograph of her. You know, like I'm sort of cobbling things together, but the feeling of the song is not cobbled together.
That's in your soul.
It's in there. Yeah.
What was your first R-rated movie?
I don't know. What I do remember is somebody in a couple neighborhoods over had HBO, and Clan of the Cave Bear was playing. I never saw it, but the rumor around school was Daryl Hannah and her boobies.
I'm sure there were boobies.
Were on screen. I didn't like the guy who had HBO, but I tried to get involved in the sleepover that was happening.
Yeah.
But I couldn't do it.
Those early cable TV days were pretty special.
Totally.
There was a lot of clandestine
viewing. Yeah, late night viewing. Even setting your alarm clock at midnight just so you wake up.
Because Porky's was on.
Exactly. But I do, obviously, Die Hard, like we said, and Goodfellas was pretty massive.
Yeah.
And there was a moment where I rented... My mom loves a good mystery, and she's also a very good Christian woman,
right?
And delightfully so. And so, at the video store that I later worked at when I was a teenager, I convinced her to rent The Name of the Rose.
Right.
Based on the Umberto Eco.
Uh-huh. Sean Connery.
Right. Yeah. And it's sort of like a monk as Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah.
And she was like, this is great. You know, it's Jesus and the Lord. It's Sherlock Holmes coming together. Yeah. And what she didn't take into account was this insanely explicit sex scene.
Yeah, that's right.
Between Christian Slater and this woman whose name I should have looked up.
Uh-huh.
She was this beautiful, I think she was an Italian actress that I'd never seen and have never seen again.
Uh-huh.
But she was this sort of peasant who picked through the trash that the monastery threw out the back of their like castle wall or something.
Right.
And when she, you know, ripped off Christian Slater's clothes, it was my first watching a sex scene with your mom situation.
There's nothing worse in the world as a young boy.
As a
nothing more uncomfortable.
Well, I don't know, was it 11 or 12 or somewhere in there.
Yeah.
But it was you know, you just lock up.
That shit was panic inducing for me.
And it was, and I think part of the panic was due to the you know, the battling forces of, you know, titillation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because blood is still rushing to your penis, whether you like it or not.
That's biology.
Yeah, exactly. Science. Can't fight with science.
Uh-huh.
And then your mom sitting right there.
Yeah.
And you hear her hand moving more and more slowly to the popcorn bowl into her mouth. And finally, she just stops eating popcorn.
Yeah.
And the chewing of her popcorn completely stops. And I remember as I was looking at it, two things. I wanted to go to the bathroom or act like excuse me, Mom, I just needed to, you know, use the restroom. But I felt like I would make more of a deal had I done that than I wanted to. And I thought, well, this will be over soon.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't over soon. It was really explicit and incredible. And also, you know, you just wanted to stay completely still, but then you think, well, that's not very natural. So you do like you stretch or you yawn, but that seems very self-conscious. And I remember at one point my mother said, after the chewing and the popcorn eating had stopped, I remember she said, well, that's very explicit.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I didn't say anything, and then it stopped, but I knew, I think I looked at the VCR, like, counter, you know, the time code.
Oh, sure.
That fake time code.
Uh-huh.
And I had an idea where that scene was, so that when she went to bed.
Yeah, you could rewatch it.
And I think she even, yeah, so I think she even, like, took the video cassette and, like, put it by her car keys or something. Like, I'm taking this back immediately.
Yeah.
But of course I went back and watched it later that evening and it was gorgeous and delightful.
Good.
And well, it's good filmmaking. It's wonderful. It's a beautiful woman. It's a beautiful man. Everything was nice about it.
Yeah. If your mom was like my parents, that for them, that probably let them off the hook from ever having to talk to you about sex.
I'm sure she checked some box in her head.
All
yeah.
Right, don't have to do that now. Number three, will you walk out of a bad movie?
I will. I will walk out of a bad movie. And it's horrible today in New York because it's like a $17 situation.
It's a loss.
It's a big loss.
Supposedly you can get your money back if not too much time has passed, I've heard.
Really?
Paul F. Tompkins said that he's asked – and that if it's within a certain time frame, then they won't give you your money back, but they'll give you a pass to come back.
I did that with God, I'm blanking on the movie now. It's that German film about the mother and the father, and it was like the best film of last year or something. It was Irma or balls. Anyways, I did that recently at the soon to be closed Lincoln Plaza Cinemas because there was nowhere to sit.
Oh. Yeah.
There were seats at the, you know, and at the very
terrible
edges.
Seats.
Yeah. And because the guys there have to deal with so many cranky septuagenarian New Yorkers, because it's like right there at Columbus, you know, or it's a couple blocks up from Lincoln Center. My friend and I just so politely and patiently
said,
that
goes a long way.
I'm sorry to bother you about this. And they give us a pass. So,
yeah, that's
actually,
cool.
No, they did give us our money back.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I didn't go back.
What have you walked out of one lately that you just hated?
Not lately. And I did try to remember the few that I have walked out of. The one that I remember from a long while ago was Strange Days.
Oh, right.
Catherine Bigelow.
Yeah. I don't think I even saw that, actually.
Ralph Fiennes.
I remember the movie.
Yeah, it was pretty bad.
Yeah. And Catherine Bigelow's great, too. That just must have been a misstep.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know where I am with Catherine Bigelow.
Well, I thought the Hurt Locker and Zero Dark Thirty were both great. I'll say that.
Yeah, I think you're definitely right. But there was some, there was a scene in Strange Days where there was some kind of like, there was some, you know, sort of future hairnet you put on your head where you right. see through someone else's eyes who, you know, I put on the hairnet and I see you looking at me in my brain. And it was some sort of future contraption like this. And there was a woman, if I remember correctly, there was a woman being raped. And this bad guy had stuck the hairnet on her. So she was seeing her own self being raped in her brain and eyes.
That's awful.
And I just said, this is enough.
Yeah.
By the same token, I saw Irreversible for the fourth time last weekend. And I still think that's a brilliant, amazing movie.
What is that?
It's Gaspar Noé, Monica Bellucci, and a 10-minute horrifying rape scene.
Oh, right.
Right. And the reason I like that film so much is because I don't think it treats rape cheaply.
Right.
It's definitely the most visceral film I've ever seen in my life. Mm-hmm. When there was a murder on screen, I thought to myself, Jesus, they've kidnapped someone and they've murdered a vagrant on screen. And I feel like in that film they treat these things. It's like if you're going to mess around with something like rape,
yeah,
let's either do it or not do it. You know, you can't go halfway on this.
Right.
And I think part of the reason I was so offended by it in Strange Days was because he was going halfway, or they were going halfway.
Well, and to use it as a...
as a plot device.
Yeah, or a gag almost.
Yeah, and in Irreversible, and there's lots of people that hate that film, and I just don't care, but... that's what the whole movie's about.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like if you're going to explore that subject, well, then
it
should be what the whole movie's about.
Right.
Or make it something else.
Right.
And also, Monica Bellucci deserved a fucking Academy Award for that movie because she, I mean, scraping cement and you know, fingernails and bloodied knees. And, you know, Gaspar Noé said that she had watched a lot of Deliverance and I Spit on Your Grave.
Wow.
And when she did this 10-minute scene with this kickboxer, who was the guy, besides the nudity, I mean, it was like she was kind of throwing everything at this performance. And it was, and to be one of the biggest stars in Europe and in the world, especially at that time, I mean, I just haven't seen, I haven't seen actors, definitely female actors, I hadn't seen anyone go for it like that.
Yeah.
In a physical way, like I saw her. It was terrifying.
I got to check that out.
Because certainly in films we have this way of, you know, we keep the very beautiful actresses in a glass box on film. And we kind of let the less attractive people kind of do the dirty work or do the stunts or do the, you know, the supporting role type stuff. You know, they're the ones who go through the death scenes or have the gore splattered on them or whatever.
Yeah.
And this was Monica Bellucci taking the whole film, like, by the throat.
Right.
And saying, no, no, I got this.
Yeah.
And it was, I don't know.
What year was that? Was it 80s?
It was the year, no, it was 2001 maybe. It was the year that All the Real Girls was at Sundance.
Oh.
Because I saw it at Sundance. People, somebody fainted. Somebody threw up.
Wow.
An enormous amount of people walked out. And they didn't just walk out. They screamed obscenities at the screen while they were walking out. The girl next to me sort of jumped over my legs and collapsed into the lap of what I came to understand was her boyfriend, who was sitting on this side of me, and spent the whole rest of the movie sort of crying in his lap.
Wow.
While he was like, he was holding her and, you know, staring at the screen.
Uh-huh. That's crazy.
Yeah, it was the nuttiest time I've had. And then of course, after the screening, Gaspar Noé, you know, he stood on stage and said, "What's the big deal?" You know,
that's only a European.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you have guilty pleasure movies or a movie? Not everyone does.
Well, I don't know if I don't. Guilty pleasure movies. I've got guilty pleasure TV.
Okay.
If I were to throw out some guilty pleasure movies, it would be like Sound of Music, but that is an incredible, incredible film. So it's not
like didn't count.
Yeah, it's not. That's not. But I.
What about guilty pleasure TV then?
But we watch Sound of Music every Christmas,
uh-huh.
And then I think every time it sort of maybe it's just a very. That's not guilty. That's just a very pleasurable movie. And I was thinking about this, and all of my stuff is like, to me, these are legitimate pleasures.
Mm-hmm.
But it's America's Funniest Videos.
Okay.
Still? Yeah.
Is that still on?
Yeah. Well, no, I don't watch the Alfonso Ribeiro stuff. I watch Tom Bergeron.
The OG?
Well, no, Bob Saget was the OG.
Oh, okay.
And then it was John Fugelsang and Daisy Fuentes.
Whoa. Boy, yeah. Okay, so you go deep.
And, well, I go just the Tom Bergeron sort of section.
Right.
And so I do that. That's what I do. And that was like the one show that all my family could get board
behind.
With. Yeah. And then I do Bud Greenspan made these Olympics documentaries for every Olympic Games.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if he still does them, and I'm not exactly sure how far they go back.
Yeah.
But I just will turn on YouTube and grab one of these, like, you know, the 1988 Calgary Winter Olympics.
Right.
And it's like all the backstories of all the Olympics, mm-hmm. or all the Olympians. You know, this, you know, Czech skier and how her father passed away and
yeah.
how he, you know, all that kind of stuff and how they carried rocks up the mountain to train and all that stuff. And for some reason, definitely like sports documentaries do it for me.
But remember Wide Wild World of Sports
mm-hmm.
when we were kids?
Mm-hmm.
That was just like appointment television on Sunday afternoons.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where as a kid we would be exposed to stuff that you had never seen before. And I felt like they always told a bit of a story too, right?
Yeah.
It wasn't just
It was like the prep story.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Yeah.
And
Great British Baking Show.
Okay. Oh, those, yeah, I love any kind of the, I like the Kids Baking Championship.
Yeah.
I'm a big cooking show guy.
Really?
Yeah. Top Chef.
For, yeah.
Like, forever.
Yeah. See, I had to do Great British because it's like, it's so multi-culti,
uh-huh.
and everyone roots for each other.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the winners was this beautiful young, you know, a Muslim woman who, you know, with an English accent, mm-hmm. and she's got four kids, and they showed her at home. And every time someone gets, you know, voted off, they surround her or him with hugs.
Oh, that's nice.
And it's like the anti-Gordon Ramsay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's not a lot of yelling or anything like that. And then it's so funny because they do all the competitions on the grounds of some Downton Abbey-looking estate.
Right.
And so the B-roll is always,
amazing.
Like, baby lambs. And, like, or, like, drips of, you know, dew sort of coming off a blade of grass.
Uh-huh.
Like, it's so anti what America is right now.
Yeah.
And that is, when fall hits, I just kind of rewatch all those seasons.
I've heard that other people talk about the show. I need to get into that.
Now it's become something else. I mean, they change stations. And so I think the first four seasons are kind of where I'm at. And, you know, they've got these two hosts, these two comedians, Mel and another woman whose name I can't remember, who just, you know, and it's such an amazing mix of, like, soft and sweet English gentility,
mm-hmm.
plus, like, insane sexual innuendo.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's just that, it's like that... That Brit humor
uh-huh.
thing, you know, this very kind of like this kind of upright, upright presentation, but with a little sort of dark underpinning, and then the craziest cookies you've ever seen in your life.
Yeah, and then you get that.
Yeah, and then I head to the store. Sadly,
movie going 101. What's your jam at the theater?
I wear a hoodie.
Okay.
To block out sounds.
Oh, you wear it during the movie?
Yes.
Oh, I never
to make sure
that.
I don't hear any talking.
So you
behind
physically
me.
Isolate yourself.
I do.
Huh.
I do.
It's a good idea.
Also, it kind of like cuts out the visual field.
Right.
So I like
that. Just have the screen, and also people around you think, is that Paul Schneider? Or is that
I don't think they
just
do.
Just some creep in a hood.
I think they think it's just a creep in a hood, and they're right. If they said I was a creep in a hood, they would be more right than if they said I was Paul Schneider. I mean, deep inside, I feel more like a creepy hooded guy than I do like whoever Paul Schneider is.
Are you by yourself, or do you shut out your wife and friends? Or do they just get
I mean,
it?
I would say no, but you'd have to ask my wife and friends.
But so you do it when you go with them, though?
A little bit, yeah.
Okay.
But sometimes I'll tuck my ears out of the hood
yeah.
so I don't miss any of the surround.
Uh-huh.
And that's either, lately it's been a lot of like cold water and Sour Patch Kids.
Yep.
If I feel like it, I can do some snow caps.
Okay.
And a couple times my wife and I have sat at the way back of the theater
mm-hmm.
and brought in some boxed wine.
Oh.
And popcorn.
Yeah.
We had an amazing screening of the live action Beauty and the Beast.
Mm-hmm.
And sat at the back and got drunk as a couple shithouse rats and ate popcorn and had the greatest time watching that.
That's great.
Mm-hmm.
Sneaking in booze. And with the box wine, you don't have to cough loudly while you open a beer can.
No, you just twist it right off and you're, chablis.
Yeah, that's a good idea because my wife and I can't, we have a kid now, so we never get to movies much anymore. But even before that, we would go to dinner and then, have a little wine at dinner. And then she's not one. She's like, she didn't want to drink in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
She's like, after I've had a glass of wine or two, I don't want to go sit in a movie theater. I'll get tired.
Yeah.
Or I'll say, well, go, or stop drinking is her thing.
Mm-hmm.
Say, we'll go to the theater where you can have the glass of wine. But that never worked either.
No. And, well, now they have a lot of the, all the theaters have food and booze there. But that's also us walking to the movie theater, that's...
Yeah, it's not like you have to drive
10 blocks away.
Yeah.
So that's why we like where we live.
That's great.
Yeah, man.
Where are you guys? You in Brooklyn? No.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That's what I thought. All right, Back to the Future?
Bring it.
All right, let's do this. I watched it last night again for the... I don't even know how many times.
Mm-hmm.
I assume the same is probably true for you.
Mm-hmm.
It's a damn near perfect movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I did see where USC Film School trots it out as the perfect screenplay in their mm-hmm. classes. So let's talk about it.
Which to me means oftentimes that I won't like it.
Because what if it's said
if it's
to be...
the if it's the perfect screenplay?
Uh-huh.
Because when I was in film school and I was watching movies like Mike Leigh's Naked
mm-hmm.
and Kieslowski's The Three Colors Trilogy.
Yeah,
and,
man, those are great.
Yeah, totally. And, or Peter Greenaway or whatever, I felt like for something to be good, they had to be vaguely negative.
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of like they had to be sort of dark and talking about serious things, and that's what made them good and smart.
Couldn't be just a big Hollywood feel-good fun movie.
Right. And then, and of course I saw, Back to the Future when I was a kid, and it was great. And then I didn't see it for many years. And then I saw it after film school, and I started to get into the idea of, like, the science of plotting.
Mm-hmm.
And the science of, you take Joseph Campbell and then you lay in math.
Yeah.
And then you get, inciting incidents and lock-ins and second act breaks and, mm-hmm. These elements that when I was younger, I thought were sort of, that's too prescriptive and it's too formulaic
mm-hmm.
and it's just not, that doesn't create a pleasurable experience for me. And also the subject matter has to be dark for it to be good.
Right.
And then when I saw Back to the Future later, I kind of really got into and started to admire like the science and the math of amazing plotting.
Yeah.
And
this one is so tight.
Last night I was thinking about how many clocks there are in the movie.
Uh-huh.
I never thought about that before. Obviously, it begins.
The whole opening
sequence, yeah. Obviously that. But then, you know, when he oversleeps, when he's headed out to meet Doc Brown, you know, at the Twin Pines Mall to see the DeLorean for the first time.
Yeah, there's a clock at the mall.
Yeah, and there's a clock on his an alarm clock on his on his bed as he wakes up and goes, "Oh shit, I'm late," or whatever.
Yeah.
And actually, there was another moment last night where he pulls out the video camera to start recording Doc explain, you know, the DeLorean and the flux capacitor or whatever. And actually, Marty looks at his watch and he shakes it.
Uh-huh.
This little digital watch, and he shakes it as if it's not working.
Right.
And then, yeah, it's just all over.
Yeah, so they were really toying with the idea of time.
And at the end, you know, one of the things that interrupts Doc from fixing the wire that connects the, you know, the lightning pole to the thing, it's the alarm or the bell of the clock tower, and it's ringing, and he can't hear anything, and it's all over. I think part of the enchantment of the sea dance, I think if I'm not wrong, it might pull out from the clock face at some point. There's, you know, of course, and then there's George McFly looking at his watch going, "I'm late to save Lorraine from this fake
assault."
Right.
Which turns out to be a real assault.
Which turns out to be super insanely serious and and dangerous.
Especially as an adult now.
Like
when I was a kid, it just seemed so light. But now, when you see things through adult eyes, that scene, I mean, it was an attempted rape.
Totally.
And scary.
Well, I remember when I was a kid seeing it and thinking, this is really bad. And I don't grasp exactly what's going on, but especially when Leah Thompson leans up and says, "George, help me."
Yeah, she's really panicked.
Totally.
Yeah.
And at that moment, and like last night when I watched it, I was like, "This is really serious. Like, this is really bad." And I'm surprised that it was. I don't think it was treated lightly back then, but I don't know if they would film it the same way now.
Probably not.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a couple of things. Anytime you go back and watch movies from the 80s through today's lens, can be problematic.
Sure.
But there was that, and of course the white man really discovers rock and roll.
Yeah,
and
right.
Chuck Berry copies him.
Right.
And I'm sure at the time they just thought, what a clever little thing here.
Right.
This is how Chuck Berry got his thing.
Right.
And they don't think about, oh, wait a minute, what are we saying here?
Right.
Really.
Or Goldie Wilson. It was a very sort of step and fetch it stereotyped black character with a gold tooth.
Right.
And, you know, kind of, "I'm going to clean up this town."
Yeah.
And that was sort of like, it was surprising to see that character so one-dimensional when all the other guys were fully realized.
Yeah. It was definitely a pretty lame way to do that.
And the Libyan terrorists.
In their VW bus.
Yeah, exactly.
That could drive as fast as a DeLorean.
Yeah. And well, whatever. That, you know, obviously terrorism was a whole nother deal. But part of the reason I liked... when I was thinking about it last night, I was thinking, why is this thing so enjoyable? And I think part of what I came up with is seeing doubles.
Yeah.
Like, we see one version in 1955 and we see one version in 1985 for almost everything.
Yeah.
Even the dog Einstein, who would never live for 30 years.
Right.
But we see a puppy.
Right.
in 1955.
Oh, I never really considered that. That's funny.
Yeah. And I think in general, there's like this deep sort of reptilian brainstem satisfaction in seeing growth and decay in time.
Mm.
We see, you know, the pediments of of the Lion Estates, the concrete Lion Estates, or in the future they're kind of crummy, and in the past they're bright and shined up, and obviously the same is true with the town.
Yeah,
and we see how people have turned out, and just like we see, you know, just like when we see YouTube videos of some father taking a photograph of his daughter the first day of school for 18 years.
I love that shit.
Right.
Yeah,
and it must be some deep human enjoyment of seeing time pass, and sort of seeing how things work out. And you know, that movie gives us a real 30-year jump. You know, we don't have to wait 30 years to see how George turns out or Lorraine turns out or whatever. I mean, we're seeing these things through Marty, and he's just as kind of blown away as we would be if we... You know, if we were in that situation, I feel like there's something in like seeing doubles and seeing time pass in an instant.
Right.
Well, and obviously backwards and forwards. But I mean, like, if that's your sort of central core idea, then I think it's automatically enjoyable to a human being.
Yeah. And I forgot what a magical feeling it was as soon as he crashes into the barn, gets shot at. Leaves, ditches the DeLorean, and walks into town. And right when he comes around that corner, when Mr. Sandman starts...
I mean, come on.
It's like, it was magic. It was like, all of a sudden, like, you're right. Like, he goes back to the glory days of that town before it was graffitied up, and there was the porno theater.
Like, I think multiple porno...
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
For sure.
Yeah.
It was a magical experience, even as an adult watching that, when he comes around and you hear that bum, 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 bum. Because I think we all sort of idealize that time. But what he learned was mom drinks and mom will get into a car and make out with a guy. And it wasn't idealized once he scratched the surface, you know?
No. It was interesting because sort of people have... Obviously, people have all the, clearly people have all the problems, you know, now that they did then and then as they do now. But there was a real, I don't know if this is a real term, but I always think of it as like psychological logic.
Mm-hmm.
Like, as much as they didn't draw the Goldie Wilson character correctly, they drew so many other characters correctly.
Yeah.
And I remember... I just wrote a note so I wouldn't forget it. Oh, right. So like the psychological logic of when Marty's back in 1985 at the very beginning of the movie and he comes home and they slap down Uncle Joey's, you know, parole cake.
Yeah.
With that sound effect that is really it's always been really jarring to me, that whack of the metal pan on that table.
Cake.
Yeah. There's a real logic to when Lorraine describes the night she met George, she talks about him having been hit by the car and then her father bringing him in. And she says, he was like a little lost puppy. He was so helpless.
Right.
And that is not the makings of a good marriage.
Right.
People don't start great marriages with that first attraction being of something that is helpless.
Yeah.
It just doesn't, and it makes sense that they'd be kind of in this kind of fracturous, laborious, drunken relationship, or at least her half of it was drunk.
Yeah.
That raised a couple of sort of, you know, annoying kids and, you know, a father who's totally withdrawn, living in the past through Jackie Gleason.
Yeah.
And everything else. And, of course, in the same way, that same woman, Lorraine, who definitely, you know, needed some kind of feeling of protection, she got it from George in the second version of the past when he said to Biff, "No, Biff, you leave her alone." and what did he do? He punched her out or punched Biff out, and then he
one
brought
of the great moments.
Yeah, definitely. And Crispin Glover's performance, we could talk about for an hour, but he punches Biff and he's looking at his hand and he's going,
yeah.
And then he turns back to Lorraine, who's on the ground, and Leah Thompson looks gorgeous in that, you know, in those moments. And he, he turns to her and he stops his sort of heavy, I can't believe what I just did breathing. Mm-hmm. And he goes, are you okay? You know, and he's so sort of, great. He's just enough of a hero. Uh-huh. Like, you're not going to take that guy and turn him into John McClane.
Right.
He it's a believable version of hero.
Yeah.
And he's just as amazed that he did what he did as his schoolmates are when they run up and say, was that George McFly?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little ham-fisted, but also very sweet when it's, is that George? You ever thought about running for class president?
For sure.
But, I mean, that punch was, that was what changed the future and set up that perhaps the most satisfying ending in movie history.
Totally.
We'll get to that in a second. But
that and there was another moment that I saw last night, or that I've seen forever, but I love, at the beginning, right when Marty meets George, the young version of George.
Yeah, in the diner.
At the diner. And Biff comes in with Billy Zane and...
I didn't realize it was Billy Zane until last night.
Yeah, and Casey Sizemico. And the other actor who's I'm sure is brilliant and a great person, whose name I can't remember. But they, you know, Biff starts bullying George about, you know, him having to, you know, recopy some reports he was going to plagiarize. Mm-hmm. And the guy in the back with the, you know, with the cut off fingered gloves.
Yeah.
He says to Biff, like, look at this guy. He's like, you know, he looks like he's in the Navy. What's with this life preserver?
Uh-huh.
And so Biff turns to him and the whole gang's focus is back onto Marty.
Right.
And they're kind of, there's like a moment of making fun of Marty. And in that moment, when they cut back to Biff, Crispin Glover, as George, is also making fun of Marty.
Oh, like, was
yeah,
he?
Yeah, yeah, what a dorky guy.
I didn't notice that.
And it was the perfect...
That's so real.
Right, it's the perfect moment of like, this guy is the victim, mm-hmm. and now the focus of the bullies and the gangs are on someone else. And what does he become? He becomes his own version of a bully.
Yeah.
He's desperate to not be a victim.
Man, I never noticed that.
Oh, man, it's the great, I don't know if that's Bob Zemeckis or Crispin Glover or mm-hmm. what, but it was such the most real, like that's the psychological logic
yeah.
that I don't see in Hollywood a ton, and I certainly don't see in those, you know, very formulaic screenplays
yeah.
a ton. And I just didn't... Again, I don't know if it's Crispin or Zemeckis, but
it's
it
a nice
was
a little touch.
Oh man, it was like to me, and for an audience member, I see that serious sort of scalpel-esque version of truthful behavior, and I can believe sort of the rest of the movie. You know, I'm mm-hmm. on board with so much of the rest of the movie based yeah. on a couple really seriously observed moments.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sort of on board with kind of whatever they do. And of course, what happens is great.
Yeah.
But they could make mistakes along the way,
uh-huh.
and I'd still be on board.
Yeah. Another moment that I thought was really kind of subtle as that you see differently as adults is when, at the end, when Marty says, you know, if I only had more time, I could go back and save Doc. I got a time machine. 10 minutes ought to do it. And as an adult, I'm thinking, oh, my God, give yourself 10 hours, dude.
Yeah, yeah,
go
yeah,
go back
yeah.
to the day before.
Right.
Like, why do you want to cut it that close?
Right.
So I was laughing at that. But then I thought, no, you know what? That's exactly what a 16-year-old kid would do.
Yeah.
Because you don't think in those terms at 16. You would, because I never noticed that when I saw it as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
I probably thought, yeah, 10 minutes is great.
Yeah, plenty of time.
Plenty of time to save him from Libyan terrorists.
And I don't remember that the last time I did this, the car cut out and I couldn't get it started.
Right. You don't consider those things
yeah,
at all.
Yeah, and I just now, you know, and just after he types that in, the car wouldn't start.
Uh-huh. There's clearly a problem with the car starting.
Yeah. Well, and that's the truth of DeLorean.
Well, yeah, that's right. Right. But there were so many little, like the car not starting, at the end, Doc not being able to plug in the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like just when you think, all right, they've got it, Zemeckis throws one more little wrench in the plan. And all that does is just ramp up the tension and the stakes. And as a 15-year-old, you don't know that's what's happening. You just know, you're like, oh my God, not that, not that.
Right. And of course, the lightning scene is my wife actually came in and we, you know, like that scene, was on, and it's just like it's undeniably tense, you know? I mean, it just keeps on working. And I think part of the reason it works so well is because all the moments of ratcheting, all the moments of tension being ratcheted up are realistic. You know, of course, the branch comes down and you know what I mean? Like it's, there's not really a jump into unrealistic action.
Yeah, it all made sense.
I mean, maybe the one moment is when he drops that connector and it rips into his pants. I mean, maybe that's a little hard
But you're, like you said, you're already on board.
Right, because other things seem so realistic.
Yeah.
Which makes me think, you know, the other thing that made me really, you know, I think admire that film once I started acting in films was this idea of the courage it takes for especially Christopher Lloyd and Crispin Glover to be so out there in their performances before they knew that that out there style of acting would fit into this movie.
Yeah, the casting of Crispin Glover and that performance just gave it enough weirdness.
Totally.
You know?
But the movie itself, you know, like, I you know, when I'm making films, I'm always not sure at the beginning, like, is it, you know, is this small realistic acting? Is this kind of, does this have a mumblecore vibe or is that what we're doing?
Mm-hmm.
Or is this, you know, you know, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory? I mean, are we like really out there? Can we do anything or are we, or can't we? And, you know, there are moments in, you know, there's Robert De Niro's performance in Cape Fear, the remake. Well, he's so out there, and his southern accent is so bad.
It's so bad.
But for some reason, I'm into it. Like, I buy it for some reason. And he knew how far to push it. And I'm really interested in performances like Christopher Lloyd's and Crispin Glover's where they can push it as, like as far as they can to the edge of a realistic performance.
Yeah.
And then they stop. Whereas that another actor who was maybe less ballsy would sort of keep it in the middle somewhere because they weren't sure what style of movie was around them.
Right.
So when we meet Christopher Lloyd and he says, "Marty!"
Yeah.
I mean, that's like if I was on set and I saw that, I'd be like, "Oh, man, this guy's going way too far."
70%.
Right, exactly. And same with Crispin Glover.
Yeah.
But those guys are so locked in. And it's almost like the movie itself sort of rose up to meet their performance.
Yeah.
I mean, granted, it's a time machine movie.
Yeah.
So, you know, obviously there's some room to play.
Well, and they got to shoot a lot of that twice, though, because, you know, the Eric Stoltz thing.
Yeah.
I mean, they shot 5 weeks.
Yeah.
If you listen to the Thomas Wilson, the guy who played Biff, he will say that they shot most of the movie. I don't think that's quite true. But I did think it's interesting, and I have seen – have you seen some of the footage?
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely freaky to see. But I think it's interesting to get a redo for the other actors and what – if that changed anything on their end, you know?
Yeah, I mean, especially if they saw any of the dailies, which I bet they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, the idea of a redo is – I mean, that's – that would be incredible.
As an actor to be able to
Oh, man, because all you do after, or all I do when I'm done acting is, you know, a couple weeks go by and then I just, you know, I just think like, oh, I could have done that better.
Yeah.
Or
I think that's natural.
Yeah, yeah. But it's surprising to me sometimes, you know, when you perform how, you know, I mean, I was in this Zhang Yimou film. Flowers of War. I was in it for like 30 seconds. But when we shot it, it was Christian Bale and I in a scene.
Mm-hmm.
And the English translation of the Chinese script was just kind of wonky. And it just didn't...
Yeah.
It was like a literal translation, which is not... which doesn't work. And I asked Zhang Yimou sort of politely... I said, "Hey, can I monkey around with the script a little bit? This doesn't sound American at all."
And he said, "What does monkey around mean?"
Exactly. No, his daughter is his sort of translator and assistant and editor, and she's just this, you know, really super intelligent, capable woman. And so Christian Bale and I sat down and kind of scooched the script around, at least this English part of the script around, and we kind of came up with what we were going to say, you know, 15 minutes before we shot it. And the budget on this thing was insane.
Yeah.
You know, there were 100 extras as dead bodies, as I'm running through the streets of this bombed out, Chinese village. And it was amazing to me that we had sort of, you know, not written the script, but we'd sort of come up with the script or that scene minutes before we shot it.
Yeah.
We shot it on a Steadicam with this hotshot operator, I think, who had just done Old Boy. So everyone was, I really wanted to get some stories for him, but he was clearly busy. But, you know, we did it, we probably did it four times on my side. We probably did it four times on Christian's side. Mm-hmm. And that was it. And it's crazy that most of the time while I'm acting, I'm doing something for basically the first time ever in my life.
Yeah.
As someone who I'm not ever supposed to have been.
Right.
And we're filming it, and that's pretty much it.
Mm-hmm.
So every movie is like me getting on the pitcher's mound during the World Series. I've never pitched before.
Uh-huh.
And then it feels like the next movie is like me in the NBA championship.
Mm-hmm.
I've never played basketball before, you know, and then it's like the finals of Wimbledon.
Yeah.
I'm not a tennis player. You know, it feels like every movie is me doing something for the first time at the highest level.
Yeah.
Or kind of with the most nerves attached.
Yeah.
And you kind of have to just kind of do it.
Yeah. That doesn't sound to me though, like a typical actor's insecurity, though. That sounds like something different. Almost like you just have to have faith of saying, all right, well, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to try to throw a fastball, see how it works.
Yeah, and obviously a lot of it is kind of learning how to look like you know how to do something.
Mm-hmm.
And because I studied editing in film school, I mean, the acting thing is very kind of late coming, and I didn't really mean to do it. But because I spent so much time editing performances in film school, you kind of learn how much power you have in changing or improving a performance.
Yeah. Is that a secure feeling?
Yeah, definitely. So I think in that respect, when I'm acting, I'm sort of into the idea of kind of giving someone options.
Right.
I mean, options that are within the bandwidth of what I think is realistic for this character in this situation.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't, you know, when I hear awards acceptance speeches or people refer to some, you know, supreme authorship of their performance.
Right.
I think to the actor, well, you know, I always want to see the shot of the editor when an actor is getting an Oscar saying,
yeah, rolling their eyes, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. And they say, like, I couldn't have done this without X, Y, and Z. And
yeah.
I think to myself, like, you absolutely couldn't have done this without the editor, you know, like.
Yeah, they never thank the editor.
No, and
granted, they should thank costuming and hair and makeup and directing, but they never thank the editor.
But I would say, I mean, all that stuff is, clearly it's legit and a big deal, but there's nobody in the filmmaking process that's spending more time staring at you and your body and your tics and your mannerisms and your behaviors endlessly than the editor.
Yeah, like stressing over individual frames of film.
Frames
to
of
make
film.
You seem as good as possible.
Right.
Yeah.
So this person has seen like the pixels of your performance.
Yeah, for real.
And what do? You thank the producer.
Your agent.
Or the studio. Right.
Your agent team.
Yeah, exactly.
And your manager.
And I mean, obviously that's about getting your next job, and I understand that. But
yeah.
I mean, as far as what who's really making your performance happen,
mm-hmm.
it's you and the editor.
Yeah.
Not even the director, you know? the director's there, they're sort of, you know, I mean, if you're, they're kind of a passenger on your particular journey.
Right.
And they're helpful to point in certain directions, but you have to get there.
Yeah.
And that brings me back to Michael J. Fox and how, you know, how a lot of times the lead character, like we've talked about, has to be bland, you know, to be able to glom onto as an audience member and go on his journey. He can't be too specific. I thought Marty was very specific, you know, obviously not quite as sort of out there as Christopher Lloyd or Crispin Glover or Thomas Wilson.
Right.
But he was in no way bland. And I think part of what I really enjoyed about his performance, like after I watched it again last night, was the physicality of it.
Yeah.
He is sprinting from one scene to the next. Uh-huh. He is playing guitar.
Yeah.
And when he plays, you know, obviously he didn't play guitar, but he learned the chords apparently to Johnny B. Goode.
Right.
So he was syncing along with the chords.
Uh-huh.
And I also respect a movie where the drummer, because I used to play drums,
uh-huh.
Both drummers were on point. The drummer for the Pinheads at the beginning, where Huey Lewis is one of the judges.
Uh-huh. Yeah, Pinheads.
He was playing the drums properly.
Uh-huh.
And then the drummer for...
Marvin Berry and the Starlighters.
There you go.
Yeah.
He was on it. But Michael J. Fox is jumping off of the amp,
uh-huh.
landing on his knees, you know, sliding on his knees.
Yeah.
When he sees Biff sort of slide off the back of, I guess it's probably Doc Brown's car that he borrowed.
Yeah.
Right. So when he slides off the back of Doc Brown's car after George has punched him out,
mm-hmm.
Marty's, and then the people behind him say, you know, is that George McFly?
Yeah.
And when Michael J. Fox sort of realizes what time it is,
mm-hmm.
and sort of busts through this crowd of extras to go get the guys to get back on stage.
Yeah.
He sort of climbs over this one woman's, like, fur, you know, mink stole or whatever she has on.
Yeah.
And really pushes them out of the way.
Uh-huh.
That's just not something that happens on a movie set.
Yeah.
You don't sort of grapple with the extras.
He does a flip over a lady at one point, too. Onto the sidewalk. Which scene is
where he like he bombs into her and sort of like he runs into her with the skateboard?
Oh, now I can't remember which part it was, but it struck me as well of like how he kind of went for it physically.
Totally.
If I'm
running through a bunch of extras, maybe I'm a bad actor, but like I don't sort of check them with my shoulder as I'm going past them.
Yeah.
But it makes total sense. I mean, this guy is, you know, the stakes used to be that he would be stuck in 1955.
Right.
That sucks.
Yeah.
But then once he starts seeing his brother and sister disappear.
Yeah, his life is threatened.
His life is threatened.
Yeah.
And so that whole formulaic script, those whole, like, you know, the math of a great script,
uh-huh.
you know, you have to have the same goal. But the stakes of that goal
yeah.
have to keep rising, mm-hmm. and the strategy for which you achieve that goal has to change
mm-hmm.
according to the skills that you've learned along the way.
Right.
And the only way you're going to completely achieve the goal is if you can finally do at the end what you were scared of at the beginning. That's like
right.
deeply Joseph Campbell shit.
Well, yeah, and at the beginning, the Pinheads fail.
Right.
And at the end, he succeeds as a musician.
Right.
If he didn't know how to play guitar, because it's just so perfectly set up.
It totally
with
is.
With Marvin hurting his hand.
Mm-hmm.
So Marty has to literally save himself and his life by getting his parents to kiss.
Right.
And even there, you think, all right, great, he's playing guitar, they're going to kiss. Zemeckis throws that dickhead in there who breaks in and says, this is my dance or whatever.
Yeah.
Can I cut in?
Right.
Just another little level of, oh, my God, will you please, like.
Yeah.
I remember being a kid being so scared that it wasn't going to happen.
Yeah, the red-haired kid
yeah.
Bothers me maybe as much as Biff bothers me.
As an actor?
Well, just because he comes in at that moment of
yeah.
like, moment of high stress. I mean, like, he sort of adds, like, the top layer of sweat on my forehead in that scene.
Yeah.
And I realized last night he was one of the three kids who was kicking Crispin Glover in the butt
The
hallway when he had the kick me sign on his back. And Strickland, what's the guy's name? He said, you know, he like grabbed the sign off his back and said, you know, get your shit together.
Yeah, yeah.
But the red-haired kid was one of those bullies.
Oh, interesting. I don't think I realized that either.
Oh, man. And he had that laugh.
Yeah.
And Alan's, Silvestri's music at that point was just like at its crescendo.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, like that, that's the last scene, you know, that scene and then the one leading up to the lightning bolt scene is just like, if you're falling asleep, which you shouldn't anyways, but like if you're falling asleep in that screening, you're awake then.
Yeah, it's just so expertly put together. And then that ending, of course, satisfying ending in 1955. And then I just remember being 15 or whatever. When did this come out? 85? 14. And when the future had changed and his parents had money and he had that truck.
Yeah.
And Biff was the car waxer. It just doesn't get any better than that. Even though seeing it as an adult, I thought, why is his brother living at home?
Totally. Yeah. In a suit.
So, you know, of course, now I thought that was kind of fun. But it just such a satisfying ending for a kid to see and as an adult. Because I think all kids think like, especially if you come like, you know, we did like little middle class kids.
Mm-hmm.
Like, man, I wanted the shiny truck. I didn't want the hand-me-down Volkswagen Beetle.
No.
I was happy to have it.
Or the 1979 Toyota Tercel.
Is that what you had?
Yeah. And what was great is that, like, during the opening sequence of the clocks and the dog food and the plutonium and all that stuff, there was a, during that kind of Rube Goldberg machine of the robot arm or whatever, at some point the radio gets flicked on. I mean, the TV gets flicked on as well, and she talks about the plutonium being stolen, and they say that it's just a clerical error. It's missing being a clerical error. At some point, the radio is turned on, and there's an advertisement for Statler Toyota.
Oh, I didn't notice that.
Which becomes, you know, the Toyota truck that he has at the end. Yeah.
Man, it's so dense.
It's so dense. But for some reason, it doesn't... That crap can get very annoying in some movies. And I don't understand why it's not this time. I mean, it's because you can't say it's subtle either, you know?
No.
Like, it's not...
It's one of those weird things that all just worked.
Right.
You know?
I mean, there was that, you know, when he jumps into the... there was one point where Marty jumps into the DeLorean, and there's a tiny tilt down to the video camera and his Walkman. And of course, those become such big deals later on.
Right.
When he get, you know, when he convinces George
Vader.
McFly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Van Halen.
It's great.
Yeah.
And then maybe one of the best, I'm a big fan of movies that have great last lines. And, and usually it's like an indie film and not some big Hollywood movie where I think it has a great last line, but Roads, where we're going, we don't need roads.
It's
like Hollywood history right there.
It's true.
You
and
know?
I don't think they, I would really like to know what was improvised or what moments they, because I think it's easy to think that nothing wasn't pre-planned.
Mm-hmm.
But I also don't think that if you do that, you get the life and the vitality sometimes.
Plus you know how movies are made in reality.
Right. But, you know, when you get that much pre-planning, you know, that much kind of, you know, over-Hitchcocked, you know, movie making, it really presses down on everything. Now, granted, if you're dealing with like a mathematician like Hitchcock, you know, yes, he was the best mathematician, and so we enjoy a lot of his films.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you could feel Jimmy Stewart or you could feel Cary Grant, like, trying desperately to, like, kind of you know, kind of molt uh-huh. out of this snake skin of yeah. of oppression.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly we know that the women he worked with were just like put in a, you know, trapped in a box.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, gazed at with, you know, insanely creepy eyes. Of course, when Grace Kelly, you know, leans in.
Yeah.
In Rear Window. I mean, you know, who's not a creep looking at Grace Kelly? But a lot of times when you feel that math happening in a screenplay, for me, it sort of strangles the ability for anyone to pop out like David Thewlis in Naked.
Right.
You know, you never get that much of a barf of mm-hmm. like humanity.
Yeah.
But for some reason, Back to the Future still has that.
Yeah.
And I wonder how much was pre-planned, how much was improv, and I bet as much as that movie feels like a constructed, rudimented, structured mm-hmm. affair, I bet that there are moments in there of just happy accidents of you know, because when you sort of set everything in a very particular direction,
mm-hmm.
I think you make you know, you make those other moments possible,
right?
And you know, I'm sure this is not the case, but like you make possible someone, you know, that last line, someone could, you know, Christopher Lloyd is so in the head of Doc Brown
mm-hmm.
that I'm sure if they didn't write that line for him, but instead said, if there's anything you'd like to say during this last point of the movie, like go for it, you know, yeah. improv a line, say whatever's on your mind.
Uh-huh.
I bet you it wouldn't be so bad. You know, it would probably be in line with what they wrote anyway.
Yeah.
But everything was so popping in that movie. Like, you know, I was looking at Leah Thompson and I was just like, man, of course. Like
she was great.
Yeah. And the whole you
Calvin
for nine. Yeah. I mean, like,
it still makes me laugh.
It totally.
When she calls him Calvin.
and the amount of physical comedy that Michael J. Fox throws in
mm-hmm.
when he's putting on his pants and then falls to the floor when he's like getting out of her bedroom. There's Dean Cundey actually sets the mirror of her in her bedroom, like this vanity mirror in the bedroom,
mm-hmm.
so we can see the door as she's leaving the bedroom. We can see her at the doorway.
Right.
And we can see Michael J. Fox in sort of like the, you know, the right third of the frame. And we see in the reflection of the mirror, she opens the door and looks back at one more view of a male in his underwear and then runs out. You know, she smiles with those bouncing curls and then she runs out. But yeah.
So cool. Really quickly, I need to tell you about the... when I went to visit my brother, who was in the DGA trainee program in the early 90s, I had never been to L.A., went and visited him. He was working at Universal at the time, and I went to get him, pick him up very late after work one night,
mm-hmm.
and it was empty. There was no one there at uni, and he said, here, go down here, go around the corner and pull around here, and sure enough, man, I pull around the corner, and this was in 19, like probably 90, so not very long after this movie was out, and I look up ahead and it's fucking Hill Valley Town Square.
Serious?
Oh yeah, the back lot. I mean, it may still be there as part of the tour,
mm-hmm.
but there was the strip of road, there was the movie theater, there was the clock tower, and a chill ran up my spine. It was like the coolest thing ever.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was great. And it was empty. It was probably 1 a.m.
And I wonder if they use, I mean, certainly they must have used that in other films.
Yeah, actually, Tony Shalhoub's movie was The Sting, and the diner from The Sting was the same as it had already been there.
Oh, really?
So they used it for Back to the Future. So it's just a working back lot that they tricked out with certain things, obviously, to make it Hill Valley.
Right.
But I think it's probably still there. I haven't been on that tour in forever.
I've never done it.
Yeah, they left it for years because Back to the Future, of course, went on to be one of the legendary movies of all time.
Mm-hmm.
But it's definitely cool, man. Even as an adult, like, to walk around that set and that lot with that clock tower.
And there's some documentary they just had out about the DeLorean, I think.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. That was a hot shit car.
It was, for a minute. And I lost what I was going to say.
That's all right. You feel good about this?
Yeah.
Did we cover it?
We sure did. Let me see if I had any other notes that I wanted to. Goldie Wilson, Toyota Lorraine, Space Camp, Leah Thompson.
Oh, yeah. God, that was great.
Yeah. It totally.
I just watched Some Kind of Wonderful again the other night.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I haven't seen that for. Maybe I've seen that once.
Speaking of Eric Stoltz.
Yeah, right.
Oh, I forgot. Yeah, they were in that together.
Yeah. And I should know this, but who was the young woman with the drummer with the short blonde hair?
Oh, Mary Stuart Masterson.
Right.
As
she was like the ducky character in that movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good one.
That she may have started her and Carrie Lowell in License to Kill. I think the second Timothy Dalton, James Bond film.
Yeah.
They both sort of jump-started my insane sexual attraction for women with short hair.
The pixie haircut?
Yeah.
Watts, that was her name. Some kind of wonderful.
Of course, it was a masculine name.
Yeah.
Oh, great.
Well, he named, it was after Charlie Watts. All the characters were named after Rolling Stones.
Well, good for him.
How about
I never would have thought that.
All right, man. Thanks.
Amazing.
This was great.
I might have to go and watch the DVD extras now.
I think maybe we should do that.
Yeah.
All right.
Thanks.
All right, everybody. That was Back to the Future with Paul Schneider. Back to the Future Plus and a whole lot more. It was fun to talk to Paul, and I wish we lived in the same town, because I think Paul and I would be pretty good buds, is my hunch. He's a good dude, and it was great of him to come in here and watch the movie the night before and take notes. It always is better when people do that and take it as seriously as you can take a fun little show like this. So many thanks to Paul. Can't wait to see what he has coming out in the hopper next. He's a discerning guy, as you learned. So I guarantee you whatever he's going to be in is going to be pretty great. So thanks a lot, everybody. Thanks for joining. And until next week, remember, it's 1.21 gigawatts. Movie Crush is produced, edited, engineered, and scored by Noel Brown from our podcast studio at Pond City Market, Atlanta, Georgia.